From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today in West Michigan, a postal facility becomes a graveyard of mail sorting equipment.
We found a number of parking lot spots filled with large pieces of equipment. And you could tell by the wires that they had been ripped from wherever they were plugged into.
Also, a scholar of Black life talks about how Michigan's metro areas both nurtured and buffeted families' financial stability.
I think that Detroit almost systematically has undergone each generation a kind of upheaval, a disturbance that have torn the fabric of the city apart and made it very difficult.
And some car talk for you Friday. Sonari Glinton drops in to tell stories about the Bronco, its life, death, and rebirth.
It says something about the nature of the industry that it took a quarter of a century to convince the folks at top that this was something viable.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, we'll dive deep into the history of an unexpected automotive icon, the Ford Bronco.
What is in the DNA of this company? What's in the DNA of these brands that can see us through to a future? And I think that that is something that is very Detroit.
That's in just a couple of minutes. But first, we sometimes experience a disconnect between what's happening and what we're being told is happening. And that happened this week. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy testified before Congress about alarming slowdowns in mail service and stories of sorting machines ripped out across America. DeJoy said that the USPS would stop removing letter sorting machines until after the election. And yet, a short Twitter video outside a West Michigan mail sorting facility has gone viral, suggesting that some damage has already been done. Wood TV reporter Heather Walker went to the postal facility and recorded large pieces of letter sorting machinery sitting in a scrap heap, waiting for the dumpster. She joins us now. Heather Walker, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
How did you hear that something was going on with the mail sorters in town? Did you just go down there and to see what you could see?
We actually received a tip to our investigative unit. We call it Target 8. And the tip was from a viewer that said a mail sorting machine was being disassembled, being taken apart as they were writing the email. And so we instantly went down there to the downtown post office location and started talking to people, started, you know, good journalism.
Right.
And with some good journalism work, we learned that there was indeed activity happening.
Will you tell us what you saw?
So the downtown location, there was nothing that we physically could see. The work was happening behind closed doors where we could not get to it. We were hoping that we would get some internal video or pictures, but for whatever reason, the person who promised to send something did not. However, we did get the information from good internal sources. Now, at a separate location, which we also received a tip about this, it's a mail sorting station that's located near the Gerald R. Ford Airport, our airport here in Metro Grand Rapids. We found a number of parking lot spots, 4 or 5 spots filled with large pieces of mail sorting equipment. And you could tell by the wires that they had been ripped from wherever they were plugged into. In addition to that, there was a dumpster that, according to workers in the area, had been filled 3 times starting last week with parts and pieces of mail sorting machines. And we took the images that we found because we wanted to make 100% sure that these were indeed mail sorting machines and pieces. We took them to the union and they did confirm that that's indeed what we were looking at. And there are a number of different pieces and mail sorting machines. We did learn that the pieces of the mail sorting machines that were at the location near the airport are for flat packages, so not mail, so it wouldn't be for the ballots, but it would be for other mail that you would receive at your home.
Understandably, any kind of large-scale dismantling of that time seems like, of that kind, seems like it would have an effect on the overall flow of mail.
Well, the union's very concerned. Employees are very concerned. I spoke to multiple employees that have been with the post office for more than 25 years, and they don't understand what's going on. They don't understand why these machines are being taken apart. They don't understand why the process is being slowed down, and they tell me that it's making their job harder. The union, though, also telling us that the workers are doing everything that they can to ensure that the mail gets out in time. They're trying to work harder to ensure that people get their packages and their pieces of mail.
Do you know if there was a plan in place to replace these machines? Is it possible that it was part of a regular turnover of equipment?
Well, that's the problem, is that we don't know the answer to that question, and we don't know the answer to many questions: why this is happening, what the plan is, will they be replaced, why were they removed. We actually went to our local postmaster here in the Grand Rapids area, and we were turned away. We were told to speak to the spokesperson. We've reached out to them as well. They've respectfully declined interviews. They've declined to answer any additional questions. And we've also received nothing from the Postmaster General. So, of course, the hearing will begin where the Postmaster General will be asked these questions. And we hope that we may find some more answers then.
So Postmaster Louis DeJoy spoke with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi this week, and he told her at the time that the plan to make changes in USPS infrastructure was not going to proceed forward and that any changes were going to happen after the election. You're saying that you haven't been able to confirm whether the equipment that you saw, that they didn't have any comment on whether it was part of an official turnover of equipment.
Well, I was told that all the equipment that I saw that had been removed and that was being removed at our downtown location was in response to the direct order from the Postmaster General, that all of the orders were coming from that level and nothing was coming from our local level.
Heather, have you heard anything in your reporting about how the dismantling of these machines is affecting mail distribution in Grand Rapids?
We don't know for sure right now. I know other places they've reported slowdowns in receiving mail. And I don't know if that's because our postal workers are working extra hard in order to ensure that doesn't happen. But the union says the real effects of the dismantlement of these pieces, which has only recently happened, are yet to be seen.
Heather Walker with Wood TV in Grand Rapids. Heather, thank you so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
We know that COVID is circulating amongst us, and yet there's a lack of basic information about exactly where in Michigan the outbreaks are happening. Some information gets out informally on social media channels, but Bridge, Michigan is reporting that there are 14 outbreaks currently associated with schools in the region over the past couple of weeks, both K-12 and at the collegiate level. But Michigan's top health officials are not saying exactly where these outbreaks lie. Robin Erb was part of the team that reported the story for Bridge, and she joins us now. Robin, welcome.
Hello.
How did you find out about these cases?
Sure. We were interested in what was happening around the state as, you know, school or our kiddos are heading back to school, our college-age kids are heading back to campus. So we simply asked the question, are there any outbreaks?
What qualifies as an outbreak? How many confirmed infections are we talking about?
When we think about outbreaks, I think a lot of us go to the idea that, you know, there are massive numbers. An outbreak, generally accepted, is as few as two people who have some kind of shared time or place to an exposure.
So these may not be super spreader events that we're talking about.
Absolutely not. But that's the problem. We don't know. The state isn't giving us a lot of details. In fact, they're giving us very, very few details about these outbreaks. So, for example, we don't know, not only do we not know how many folks are infected, we don't know if they're K-12 schools, we don't know if they're colleges or universities, we don't know if they're public or private. We don't know if they're staff or students or athletes.
When you and your colleague Ron French asked the state health department about this, did they give a rationale for why they weren't releasing specifics?
And to some extent, it makes sense. You know, public health, their role is to, you know, stop the spread of disease, contain it, let people know if they're exposed. But they also have to balance that against, you know, privacy concerns. So, you know, the way they do that is generally finding out exactly who the direct contacts are and then contacting those people to let them know of risk. So they don't necessarily publicize that, you know, a certain daycare has an outbreak or a certain school has an outbreak or a certain business has an outbreak. Their focus is on contacting those people with direct exposure.
Is there a tacit understanding that to this that sort of contact tracing is going to be enough, that would stop the spread of infections? I mean, it seems like a lot more people would be able to take action if there were public notices about this stuff.
Right. And that's part of the concern. You know, we're not talking pertussis here or, you know, some of these diseases that we know so much about now. What we're talking about is this COVID, and it's, you know, we don't know a lot about it, and it is scary. And there is a big concern, especially among families, as they're sending their kiddos back to school, about exposure, not only for those kids, but what those little guys may bring home to. And, you know, I keep saying kiddos, but we're also talking college age students, too.
Mm-hmm. Robin, have you had any updates from the state since you published the story about the location of these COVID cases?
The state did tell us yesterday that they did give us the regions. So when we wrote the story, we didn't know where in the state these were. You probably have seen some of the other reporting since. We didn't report it because it was kind of my, you know, a small turn. But the cases are up along regions 1, 2A, 2B, and 3. That's Southeast Michigan and then working up through the thumb.
Robin, your expertise is in public health. It's frightening to think about COVID in schools and maybe not every parent in a school population knowing if there had been an outbreak. But are the outbreaks we're talking about any more threatening than, say, the risk of walking into a grocery store or, say, a waiting room at a doctor's office right now?
That's a great question. And really, the answer is we don't know yet. We're still learning about things like asymptomatic spread and how the virus affects different age groups. So at the end of the day, we don't know if this is any different than, let's say, your grocery store or your doctor's office or some other place that you walk into.
Robin, having learned what you did about this, what do you think is left for parents who are getting ready maybe to send their kids back into school in Southeast Michigan? And we should repeat, we're talking about some outbreaks in Southeast Michigan. What's left for parents who might be concerned about the health situation at their school?
If your child is in direct contact with somebody who's been infected, you will know. Theoretically, the health department or the school will let you know that. So there is some reassurance there. And then, of course, teaching your kids all about those social distancing protocols and safety protocols. That's a big thing.
Robin Erb is a reporter with Bridge Magazine. Robin, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the Ford Bronco gets a fresh, modern look, but its history is just as interesting as its return to the spotlight.
Finally, Detroit automakers are looking at what people are desiring.
We're talking with Sonari Glinton, host of a new podcast about the Bronco, after the break. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Ford's rollout of the new Bronco was one of the marquee online events of the summer. Millions of people tuned in for either the online reveal, some of the network coverage, or caught a piece of the vast advertising blitz as one of the most iconic Fords, the Grand Dam of SUVs, was reborn for a new generation of consumers. Ford also commissioned a new podcast to tell stories about the Bronco.
The new Ford Bronco for 1966. A rough, tough, go-anywhere, climb-anything sports car.
So as they are developing the Bronco, the Mustang is the sport pony, and the Bronco is going to be the sport utility pony.
That phrase, sport utility pony, often got replaced with sport utility vehicle, and that was the founding of an acronym, SUV, that now describes more than half, of the vehicles being produced in America.
And the mind behind that podcast is none other than Sonari Glinton. You know him as a journalist born and raised in the Midwest who spent many years working in Michigan, covering a range of issues, including economics and the auto industry, for public radio and elsewhere. These days, he's in L.A. and is the executive producer of Delight Media. Sonari Glinton, welcome to Stateside.
It's a pleasure.
Do you ever drive a Bronco?
Have I ever driven a Bronco? Not the new ones, no. I'm trying to think, but yes, I definitely have a Bronco 2 and then the first generation Bronco. Those are very, very popular. They're amongst the most expensive vintage automobiles because relatively few of them were made. And if you think about it, no one who bought a Bronco in the late 60s put a tarp over it and put it in the garage and was like, I'm going to make money off of this thing.
Yeah.
So they're very valuable.
They're like the hipster turntable of Broncos.
Well, yeah, it's that's the real reason why Ford is going there, right? I saw a Bronco that was $300,000. Like I said, this is the anti-car market. It's not, let's not make it into hipsters, because what it really is that in the antique or vintage car world, it used to be, you know, middle-aged dudes who wanted muscle cars or sports cars, right? But in the last decade or so, we've seen an influx of women and younger buyers in the antique or vintage car world, and they're buying SUVs and pickup trucks. And again, like I said, those things have already an innate value, because nobody's grandfather had an F-150 that they thought they were going to sell, you know, 40 years later. Right? They were just going to run them into the ground. And so I believe that Ford looked at this universe of people buying new antique Bronco bodies, buying used or vintage Broncos for hundreds of thousands of dollars, and being like, we don't have a genuine 4x4. And that to me is an amazing part of, you know, what this conversation is, which is, I think, is finally the Detroit automakers are looking at what people are desiring, right? Instead of, you know, making another car because it has an E at the front of it.
Right. You open the podcast with this most beautiful, evocative narrative of this guy named Mike, who's recalling his childhood and his uncle, the fun uncle, who does all of the things that your parents don't really want you to do, and the stories of the Bronco that they drove across backcountry Colorado, and Mike ultimately inheriting the car and fixing it up.
I was 13 years old, so I had just finished middle school, and my parents thought it'd be a good idea for me to go out and spend the summer with my uncle.
That's Mike Lavanino. He's now almost 60, but he still remembers the summer he spent in the mountains with his Uncle Rima.
He was really, really cool. He was the uncle that every kid wanted and no parent kind of wanted to have. he would give you all the things an uncle should give you. I mean, for one of my Christmases, he gave me a gerbil. He always gave us water guns and water balloons and everything your father or your mother really doesn't want flying around the house.
They spent the summer of 1974 crisscrossing Colorado in a Bronco.
We would go over some of the passes, Mosquito Pass, I can remember vividly. We also went out looking for mushrooms quite often. It was a great mushroom year. He used to dry mushrooms. They were Italian, so we used to use them in spaghetti sauce and things like that. So we were always in the Bronco.
And it's just such a gorgeous summer sun-drenched story of the Bronco mystique, you know, the ruggedness, the nostalgia vibe, and this romance of death and rebirth that mirrors the Bronco's own story. But Sonari, I mean, this is also a vehicle that people put snowplows on, that people, you know, installed giant woofers in the back and cruised around their neighborhoods in and put groceries and Golden Labs in the back of. How is it that this one vehicle has such a marvelously adaptable persona?
Well, you know, if you think about it, you know, the Bronco and its brethren came about, you know, from World War II vets who are used to driving Jeeps. And, you know, International Harvester came out with a Scout in the 50s or early 60s, and then the Bronco. And that was kind of it, right? You could have a Jeep, you could have an International, you could have a Scout, and maybe you could have a Bronco. And it wasn't the consumer didn't really catch up until literally the mid to late 90s. Mm-hmm. And what the Bronco was supposed to be was goes over all terrain. They wanted to call it the GOAT. And a vehicle that did everything, that was rugged and those things. And when we realize that's what the aspirational image of a lot of buyers is, right? It is, you know, I'm a tough woman who gets things done, right? I take care of my family, I can haul, I can do all of these things. I can put the soccer team in the back or tow a boat. And I think that when we like that idea that a vehicle can be all things for one family is not really true. I wish the people didn't think that way sometimes, but the Bronco represents something, I think, aspirational, kind of the way that we thought about the frontier and the Wild West. You know, it's a very important part of the American spirit, which is forging a new path, making something new, going off-road, creating your own rules. And I think that that's a part of what the Bronco symbolizes.
You spend a fair amount of time solving the mystery of why the Bronco went away, which it turns out is a little bit more complicated answer than sales. I'm hesitant to ask you to spool it out here because the way that you tell it in the podcast is such a wide-ranging, unexpected tale that involves Iceland and the Detroit uprising and OPEC and just a whole slew of other things. But is there a short answer that you can give us for why the Bronco was discontinued?
Stupidity.
Didn't know what they had, huh?
Well, you know, I mean, come on. I mean, isn't that Detroit, though? I mean, really? In like, the, when I say Detroit, I mean the Detroit the
industry. Yeah, right.
Yeah. It is, you know, we created this thing. We created a whole class of car, whether it's the muscle car or the sedan or the pickup truck or one of those things, right? And, you know, you think about the 90s, there was a lot of different corporate priorities for a company like Ford. They ended up buying brands like Jaguar and Land Rover. And, you know, and what we've had in the last 10 to 15 years is a shakeout where it's the, you know, Ford has sold off all of those brands and has gone back to the core. It's even gotten rid of a bunch of cars. The same has happened at General Motors and Chrysler, where it's like, who are we? What do we represent to the consumer? But why the Bronco went away, I think, is it wasn't a shiny object anymore, right? And that is often what the corporate chieftains do, right? And I think that in the last 20 years or so, the F-150 has done so well, Ford is just sort of like, well, since we make over 90% of our profits on the F-Series truck, why should we do anything else? And as things went along, they looked and saw 60% of the vehicles are SUVs. And for those of us who right now, especially in this pandemic, it seems like good timing, a lot more people are going off-road. Mm-hmm. A lot more people going camping right at this moment, right? Mm-hmm. People are buying $300,000, like I said, Broncos. And if you're a car company, you look at that and you're like, oh, we had a good thing going. Maybe we should bring it back. And it says something about the nature of the industry that it took a quarter of a century, of dedicated Ford designers, marketers, all those people to convince the folks at top that this was something viable. And I think that that's almost more of a story to me, which is the skunk works that existed to reintroduce this vehicle. And what an uphill battle you have to just come up with a decent idea in a gigantic company like Ford or General Motors or Chrysler.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sonari Glinton. He's hosting a new podcast called Bring Back Bronco about the history of the iconic Ford truck. He's also a longtime journalist and public radio producer. You know, for some people who maybe aren't big car people, what they know of the Bronco is that O.J. Simpson was in one of them when he was pursued on live television down the 405 in L.A., mm-hmm. Oh, which, by the way, set up a seminal moment for America's conversation on race and power. You made an intentional decision to revisit that incident. And I was wondering if you could tell us about why you decided to do that.
It would have been, no one would have taken this podcast seriously if we had talked about the Bronco and hadn't talked about O.J. Simpson and what happened to the brand after that, right? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have done the show, right, if we weren't going to talk about O.J. Because that white Bronco is seared in the memories of people like me. I was working at Ford inside of a Ford plant as a college student during the slow speed chase. And that's what I think that one of the things that we tried to do in this podcast was, you know, is a product that's as big and as expensive as a vehicle, when it's made in Detroit, when it's designed in Detroit, it's connected to the heart of America and what's going on at the time. And it's not a surprise that the, you know, the uprisings in Detroit, the OPEC, the denouement of the classic Detroit that we think of would all play a role in the story of the Bronco. I mean, there is, you know, I am the third generation car person in my family who's had a career connected to cars. That is not unusual if you're a black person in the middle class. These companies touch African Americans and they touch America in a way that we don't always acknowledge. And I think that peeling back to see, oh, it's not just a product, right? It's a product that represents in many ways freedom and in many ways economic freedom. And think about even in the even when you look at it in the that, you know, an accused murderer and his friend are fleeing, there's that, that's the one top line that you see. But then the vehicles represent what it has for so many African Americans, which is freedom, right? That is some, that was a powerful thing that was happening despite the horror that happened to Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman. Like, you know, it's not a surprise to me that a vehicle will be connected to some of the most iconic events in American history. And you can do it with many other vehicles, right? You can do it with a Lincoln, right? We could have done this with Lincoln and seen how, you know, John F. Kennedy was killed in one and et cetera, et cetera. Like these, they play such a role in our lives. Why wouldn't we talk about them? And I think that exploring what they mean and how they're built and what the companies were thinking is truly fascinating and goes way beyond being a car person. It's like, you know, last night I was watching I watched a documentary about video games followed by a documentary about the Barbie doll. They didn't spend $1 billion on the Barbie doll, right? You know what I mean? You know, they don't spend, right? It's like, but we will eat up, I mean, great documentary on the Barbie doll, right? We'll eat up, you know, all of that. And I believe that this is way closer to the heart of who we are as, whether it's Midwesterners or people or African Americans or just Americans.
You point out that Detroit, as the city that gave birth to the Bronco, was at the center of industrial America at the time the Bronco was conceived. It was the center of political America in a lot of ways, certainly the center of musical and cultural America. In the long tale of how the Bronco came back, what does modern-day Detroit have to do with the rebirth of the Bronco?
Well, I think the idea of rebirth is a narrative that we're going to be probably hearing about Detroit for the next half century. This vehicle actually sort of, in my mind, represents a rebirth of the auto industry in an interesting way. Going local, the auto industry has gotten more local. Build the cars where you sell them and listen to the consumer. That's one of the things that the auto industry is doing. But what you see is the engineers, the designers, all those folks who are living in Detroit and watching this renaissance, watching a renaissance in Detroit, grappling with a new city and seeing, oh, we have essentially these new car companies. Right. And instead of running from their past, it's looking to see what is in the DNA of this company, what's in the DNA of these brands that can see us through to a future. And I think that that is something that is very Detroit.
Yeah.
Is that we have a heritage and how can we make that heritage match with the present? And I think there are a lot of people doing that with products in Michigan and with the automakers. But I think really, really, whenever I set foot in Detroit, I think of the decades that I've been there and the sheer opportunity that you feel. And you don't see it like, and that's something I get excited about. And I say to folks all the time that if I was 24 and you asked me where would I want to go, I would say Detroit. Because it's as exciting to me, as challenging as it is, as difficult as it is, you know, post-bankruptcy of the auto industry, all those things, that there is a rebirth happening. And we're not going to get help from other folks. We're going to have to roll up our sleeves and do this for ourselves. And I think that that's really, I don't think that you would have gotten that ethos in a Toyota, right? Because that ain't the, that's not the ethos of that brand. You wouldn't have gotten it in Mazda. But roaring back and thinking of freedom and reclaiming a heritage that's over 100 years old, I think that that's an opportunity for the car industry.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sonari and I will continue our conversation and talk about the many ways that race has penetrated our society and his work over the years.
Bronco. Bronco. Ford Bronco. First four-wheel drive sports car, blazing a new trail of excitement. The new Ford Bronco for 1966. A rough, tough, go-anywhere, climb-anything sports car. Choice of powerful six or big new 200-horsepower V8 engine. Clear out snow in four-wheel drive. Cruise down a road in two. Two-wheel drive without annoying whine. Smooth as silk on paved roads, Ford's new Bronco gives you synchronized shifting. Velvet smooth coil spring drive. Bronco Roadster, built for fun. Bronco Sports Utility, a do-anything workhorse. Bronco Wagon, family carry-all. Name of Bronco, a new V8 Bronco at your Ford dealer.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's continue our conversation with Sonari Glinton. He's the host and producer of a brand new podcast called Bring Back Bronco, The Untold Story, released by Ford about the iconic truck. And he's also a longtime journalist with extensive experience in radio and podcasts. I wanted to talk to you about something else while we have you. I was curious about what it's been like for you to see where the country is right now. We're at a time when there is a huge conversation right on the front burner about representation in journalism and in public media. And in my lifetime, you were the first Black reporter I remember leaving the network and saying, you know, this is not working. You know, there have to be changes. And I just wondered what it's been like for you to watch many stations and multiple big players in the industry having to figure out where they stand with respect to Black workers and other people of color.
You know, not to name drop, but I'm working on a project with Quincy Jones. And when I was leaving public media, I've had the opportunity to hang out with him and hang out with, you know, groups of all Black creators. And that feeling of being around professional African Americans who were getting things done and doing things stood in stark relief to me for stations and my life in stations. You know, I worked at WUOM, or Michigan Radio, mm-hmm. you know, where there was one other Black person in the building, you know. I worked at WBUR, first Black full-time reporter in its history. Same thing at WBEZ, the first Black reporter, the only Black male reporter on Planet Money, the only Black male reporter on NPR's business desk. And honestly, that translation sort of got to me, right? And the thing that Quincy Jones said to me, which was really interesting, is don't become a prisoner of your dreams. When you are in a situation where you're frustrated or upset or angry, it's usually because you're thinking too small. And that idea of wrestling, you know, a public media station into understanding what it means to be a gay Black man or all those things, I didn't feel a need to do that when there are people out there in the audience who are desperate for us. We saw that with the DNC this week. You know, mm-hmm. for instance, you know, I have said all of my career to folks that Black women vote more. They go to church more. They buy more books, and they're more concerned about travel than any other demographic group. We know that to be true. They will eventually get a college education. You know, this and public media needs to realize that what makes me comfortable may not attract an audience, right? And for me, what I realized is I could be sitting around trying to convince, you know, a middle-aged or an elderly station director in the middle of the country or someplace like that, that I have value or that Black women have value, or I can go create that value for myself. The one thing I love, you know, I worked at Michigan Radio, and those of you, you all remember Jen White, who now hosts
1A.
1A. You know, yeah. I would rather jump on a landmine, right, than do anything that offended someone like her, right? Or Tanya Mosley or Michelle Norris. That in these organizations, what I feel about these women and being a minority is, you know, we can't be as free to express who we are because we're just visitors in these organizations. And I firmly believe that I believe in more public media, not less, right? I believe that we are, when we think about the model of public broadcasting, I know that a lot of folks in public media go, well, will Black people support, you know, a station with donations? And I know that that's what people think. They know, mm-hmm. I know, because they say that to me. And I know that I've gone to enough fried chicken dinners and church potlucks to know that we know how to pass the hat to get yes. us the information that we need. And the reason people don't, Black folks aren't listening to public media is not because they're stupid or not interested. It's because they don't hear themselves represented. Every stat that you have ever seen shows that more diversity means more efficient groups. They are more successful. Always, 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 always. And every time you see it, there's more money. Educated Black women run things. They get things done and they want information. And all you have to do is not give them the finger, not turn them off. Open yourselves to them and have people that they can connect to on the air, in print, and online. And until you do that, until you conquer the entirety of your audience, don't come talking to me about the model's broken. You know?
Sonari Glinton is the executive producer of D-Light Media, and also he can be heard right now hosting Bring Back Bronco, The Untold Story. Sonari, it's so awesome to hear your voice and to hear you chasing the dream in Los Angeles. Take care.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Talking about the systemic racism that restrains Black families from much of the stability and prosperity that the American middle class enjoys means confronting a lot of things that have happened with money over the years. A lack of access to capital for Black people is a fact of life, whether you're buying a home or a car, maybe starting a business or getting ready for your kids' education. And Metro Detroit is perhaps as good a place as any in these United States to see and talk about what's happened over the decades and even centuries. Author, educator, and activist Herb Boyd has written about 24 books about Black history and culture, among them Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. He joins us now. Herb Boyd, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April. It's good to be with you.
Herb, I think it's hard for some white people to look at Detroit and see what happened with all the economic opportunity of the 1940s, and to look at the boom years that immediately preceded this pandemic shutdown, looking around and seeing all the change in the city, the businesses, the new housing. And they can't always put together why and how the full measure and the full benefit has been denied to Black Detroiters. How do you start to talk about the structural forces at work here?
It's a very complicated and challenging, difficult situation to sum up. We need a lot of time to do that because it's taken a lot of time for this situation to kind of develop or evolve into what it is today. I think the overarching, and if you're going to put it in historical perspective, is always to keep in mind that the U.S. continues to be suffering from a very, very deep systemic racism. You might say the body politic is infected with this systemic racism. And it's going to take a while to remove it because the pandemic as well as the so-called Great Recession, it's kind of made that situation of disparity, racial disparity, income inequality, even more transparent. But, you know, this situation has been festering for years. And, of course, if you take and see Detroit as being symptomatic or symbolic of that, and I certainly do, the situation there as it pertains and as it existed over the years is a condition that is widely shared by other communities and municipalities in this country.
Can you talk to us about the confluence of Black populations seeking wealth, maybe during the Great Migration, and the violence that those wealth seekers faced?
Oh, yes. The Great Migration is a very historical milestone in American history. I was a part of it. My mother brought me and my brother to Detroit just a few months before the race riot of 1943. In effect, April, that was my introduction to Detroit. It's suddenly, boom, you know, this
right
cataclysm that swept across the city at that time. And, of course, my mother, she actually experienced a very brutal situation in which a Black man was kind of gunned, his body shot in half out on Holbrook and Russell Street. One of the things we can say about, you know, these riots or rebellions that we've had, no matter where they occur in this country, it takes years of recovery, because what you've experienced, you know, first of all, you have like the fissures that occur in race relations, compounded by, you know, personal and property loss, those kind of things, and job loss. All those things, you know, taken together makes it very difficult for recovery. I think that Detroit almost systematically has undergone almost with each generation a kind of upheaval, a disturbance that have torn the fabric of the city apart and made it very difficult for employment and the whole production, manufacturing. Of course, with the 1940 situation, particularly with the arsenal of democracy, World War II was going on at that time, so many African-Americans, you know, had prosperity opportunities because they got job opportunities that did not exist before. And so you have Detroit as like an epicenter in terms of the manufacturing boom of these automobile plants being converted into munition plants. So that was another part that spurred, you know, even before that, if you go back to the 1920s with Henry Ford and his $5 a day offer, that spurred migration in this country. You know, when you look at the paradox of it all, that it has both positive and negative aspects. So we kind of focused on the positive end as opposed to the kind of systemic racism that was very, very apparent.
How explicit were some of the covenants and rules, both in housing and finance, that really put restrictions on what Black families could achieve in those years after the Great Migration?
You know, you had a white population that was not that receptive in many parts of the city. That we could not just choose to live where we wanted to live. You had neighborhood, you know, organizations that blocked that. You had a government that was predisposed to do little or nothing. So we had these conditions over the years in which the African-American community is like met with all kind of opposition. Can you get the loans? Were the banks receptive? You know, how was your credit rating? You know, what's your background and history? So accumulating wealth, of course, home ownership is just absolutely critical in that process. We were denied those opportunities and possibilities. So all of that hampered our opportunities to grow and join that kind of so-called flourishing middle class, although many of us, because of our perseverance and our determination, did enter into the kind of growing middle class of the city of Detroit.
I know that you're a student of Malcolm X, and you knew him when he lived in Detroit. How did his teachings about Black wealth influence your own ideas?
My goodness. Well, for me, in terms of my political development, the kind of consciousness that I have in that regard, it all pretty much started with Malcolm X. what happened was is that if you go back to when I was 19, 20 years of age and really interested in developing myself as an intellectual, as a writer, you know, Malcolm came into my life. And whenever he visited Detroit, you know, after I had been introduced to the Nation of Islam, I made it my business to be there to hear him. So when he was scheduled to come to Detroit in February the 14th, 1965, to speak at Ford Auditorium, at that time I was working at Dodge, Maine in Hamtramck and working the graveyard shift, as they call it. And when I heard that his house had been firebombed earlier that morning, I just took it for granted that Malcolm would not be coming to Detroit. Well, lo and behold, much to my chagrin, he arrived and spoke at Ford Auditorium, and friends of mine told me that they could smell the smoke on him because all he could salvage from his house in East Elmhurst was what he had on. And so I made my mind, April, at that point, that what I was going to do, if he could go through all of that in the early morning hours of the 14th and get on a plane and come to Detroit, you know, I'm going to New York. And then within days of my preparation to depart, he was assassinated on the 21st, a week after his house was firebombed. Mm. Oh, I say, my goodness, you know, I just couldn't bear to go to the funeral at that time. I made it my business to say, okay, I'm going to continue his journey and get my education together.
Right. Malcolm X talked about black wealth as something that was really integral in his view to black liberation. And he was very, very emphatic about the importance of money staying within the community. Can you tell us a little bit about how that influenced your own ideas about economics and how it might work in a place like Detroit?
Well, all of that is part and parcel of what Malcolm was talking about in terms of his black nationalism. You know, he was saying that, of course, you know, he was a convert of the Nation of Islam. He was mentored by Elijah Muhammad. Muhammad, of course, had grew out of Marcus Garvey, Noble Drew Lee, and a number of other black nationalists who all began to talk about black empowerment, talked about self-determination, about doing for self, you know, particularly in view of the kind of hostility, the racism, discrimination, oppression they faced coming from the larger society. You had no other option, no alternative but to kind of build your own stores, you open up your own businesses and do for yourself. So all of that grew out of the Nation of Islam. And of course, Malcolm coming into that context was imbued with those same ideas. His black nationalism was like expressed a much larger tableau, you might say, because it had not only the economic, it had the social cultural components as well built into it. So when he talked about blackness, when he talked about black nationalism, he was talking about, you know, overall philosophy that had economic, political, and social potentialities. And he played all those things up wherever he talked. So all of this is part and parcel of Malcolm's overall philosophic approach, one that he maintained right to his death, even though he had begun to incorporate the Muslim faith into all of that.
Herb Boyd is an author, an activist, and an educator who grew up in Detroit and has written many books about black history and black theory, and who taught for many years at City College in New York. And he's among his other books, he's the author of Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, which is about as good as a starting guide to living in Michigan as this newcomer has ever seen. Herb Boyd, please keep safe, and thank you so much for talking to us on Stateside today.
It's good to talk to April in August.
I'm here all year.
Thank you, baby. Bye-bye.
That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. Have a safe weekend, and we'll see you on Monday.